You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Kathy Morris. Kathy, it's good to have you here.
Great to be here.
So, Kathy, the way the show begins is with a huge question. Who are you? What do we need to know about your things you've done, the values you aspire to live by, the places you've been? What do we need to know to just start the conversation?
Well, there's a word in yoga, prana.
Uh-huh.
Which, are you familiar with it?
Explain it, because even if I am familiar with it, I might misdo it.
Well, I was interested to know how you thought about it. But anyway, prana, although it, in a limited way, it refers to the breath,
mm-hmm.
But in a larger sense, it's the life force.
Right, right.
Life force and the movement of the life force. So
right.
Movement and rhythm are a big part of what I'm about.
Right, right. And in Hebrew, it's ruach, and that's the breath of life, and winds too. So, and I'm familiar. One of the most beloved teachers in the seminary I attended was doing yoga back in the 40s and 50s, and he would teach voice courses in seminary in the 80s, and he introduced us to the concept.
Nice.
But everybody defines it in their own way. Thank you. So the breath is important and central to you, the prana, as well as the life force. And how has that defined your life, that awareness?
I don't think it was originally an awareness about the breath, and it's not like I've got this breath thing all figured out either.
No. I mean, but we practice many times a day. Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, good point. But even the rhythm thing, I think it's only in recent years, I think that I've got that's a thread.
Mm-hmm.
And even thinking about coming to talk here with you, that started to come up, especially, you know, spending all those hours looking at watching YouTube videos.
Right. Right.
You know, it's just there are certain rhythms that just speak to me, mm-hmm. over and over, you know, and that have been and been a part of my life, like you know, the dance club in junior high in New York City, you know, doing the Continental to Hit the Road Jack by Ray
right.
Charles, you know, like just that spoke to me.
right. And where does that live in your body? I mean, where does that how does it actually affect you?
Well, it's interesting because I'm just turned 70, and you know, I think in some ways one of the most things that's still most important to me is to dance. And I don't know that even that many people who know me, not everybody who knows me honestly thinks of me as a dancer either.
Right.
And I'm not a dancer.
Part of your life.
But it's like as long as I can get in touch with that rhythm, with the dance, you know, like mm-hmm. and certain rhythms come up and I just have to move, you know, and
right.
that's the deal.
Right. But it is identified with the rhythm that catches you, that somehow.
Yeah.
And that you apprehend it.
Yeah, and that I take it in my body.
Right,
you know,
right.
And I mean, give it back out.
Right, right. And knowledge that is taken in somatically is knowledge that we apprehend.
Mm.
And knowledge mm-hmm. that we take cognitively is knowledge that we comprehend.
Mm,
and
nice.
We learn mm-hmm. both ways. And it's just that you've made one of the clearest statements of that difference.
Good.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah. And that's a big part of yoga, certainly the yoga tradition that I'm in, mm-hmm. which is Iyengar yoga. Because there's a lot of sort of fine tuning and demarcation of consciousness,
mm-hmm.
and how we take things in,
right.
and you know, of course, I've had to learn that too as a teacher.
Right, right, right. And what have you taught?
Gosh, I've taught photography and all different kinds of photography. I've taught drawing and lots of things in the arts, and then. Since 1995, I've taught yoga.
Mm-hmm.
And now, I mean, at this point, I teach an average of 6 classes a week of mm-hmm. yoga classes. Yeah.
Neat. So Kathy, you brought some music with you. What would you like for us to open the show with?
Well, when I was going through the YouTube videos, I mean, the one that sort of like the purest expression for me of that rhythm,
uh-huh.
From the 1960s. I mean, Motown in general is it comes pretty close,
right? Right, right.
In the African roots, but what is his name? Thurston Harris. Yeah, Little Bitty Pretty One.
Okay. Well, here we go. Listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Kathy Morris. So Kathy, where I like to go is to next is to ask you, given the life that you have come to value, that you live now, what did you have to learn? What were some of the experiences you needed to go through to know what that life is and what you have to do to live it?
Pay a mortgage.
So you like stability and rootedness in a place.
Yes. Yeah. And when I bought my little house in Newfield in 1985, and that was after a period of a certain amount of rootlessness. I mean, when I bought the house, it took a year to collect suitcases and cardboard boxes from various apartments.
Places you left them and stored them and whatnot.
Yeah, under people's beds and everything.
So you literally ingathered yourself.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, and so, the house has just become this kind of collage of my being. And I certainly, it's funny because it's, it's been, 34 years or something. Right. And I never, it's not something I ever pictured. I mean, that this would be my life,
right?
This little house in Newfield.
So what possessed you to buy a house in Newfield?
I probably had some rational reasons, like this particular...
It doesn't have to be rational.
Well, so much of it...
Maybe you had some rational reasons.
Well, I know I'm sort of always proud of myself when I do. It's not really my temperament. But, a lot of the things that happen sort of come from this little voice. Is I want that. I want that. I want it.
It pleases me.
That would make me happy.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what happened with the house?
Well, I had seen it. I had visited. It was near. I was actually living on a commune, which is Dawes Hill Community, which is known in known in this area at that time. It was the when I was there, it was the late 70s already. and the old German guy who had built the house, was still living in the house, he was known to the people in the commune because mm-hmm. he helped them start their beekeeping enterprise. Mm-hmm. And I went to visit him, and there was something about that little house with its little garden and the trees, and it had a basement, and I thought, I could put a dark room. That was one of the rational reasons, uh-huh. the basement where I could put the dark room.
Right.
Yeah, so, it took some doing. I knew nothing about buying a house. I mean, I went to the bank, and, I didn't really have, it was the hippie days.
Right.
You know,
you're like, coming off the commune.
Yeah. Or, at some point, it was a little later than yeah, that. Yeah, but yeah. The idea of, having like a recorded income and showing, your taxable income and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had worked in a restaurant off the books. I mean,
right.
I put $100 in my account every once in a while. And so I just remember the expression on this poor woman's face in the bank. She just, they just couldn't do it.
Right.
And it was so, it was really kind of crushing. But then I went back to the little cabin in the woods I was living in at the time, and just sort of got used to the idea. Well, I guess that little dream isn't going to work out. And so once that resignation or acceptance kind of really sank in, the phone rang, and it was friends that I had originally approached about borrowing the money, mm-hmm. who had originally said they didn't think so, and then it was them calling back to say they'd reevaluated and decided they could. Mm-hmm. So bless their hearts.
And, right.
So that's how I bought the house.
Wow. And I mean, in a certain sense, a profound sense, that's a share economy. In terms of just of what we need for financing, and did they loan you the money or
I paid it back
like a mortgage. Yeah,
I paid it back.
Yeah. So in some ways, that was your real, at least in this telling, that is an early foray into financial accountability.
Yes, and it's been a long, slow, gradual foray,
Right.
So, it's like I feel like, I never really lived a kind of conventional life with really any understanding at all of retirement income or stocks and bonds or IRAs or, mm-hmm. Any of that.
Right, but looking back on where you were migrating from, and you were probably in your mid-30s at that point.
Yes.
Was that like other things you were looking for in your life at that time?
Buying the house?
Yes.
Oh, that's a good question. Probably. Yeah. I mean, it's taken me a long time to... Not that I'm there yet, but to have more of a sense of that stability in the end is an internal process.
Right.
So I spent a long time, and I say it's a process of, and in some ways, it's true. Like having a house, having my own house, mm-hmm. having that those roots, really is stability. Yeah, it really is. But. The other things like, trying to find it in certain kind of conventional relationships and things like that. Mm-hmm. That hasn't been your life. No.
But you did find work.
Yes. That's been an interesting patchwork. That kind of work.
Right.
Patching.
And, yes. And so let's I'm going to suggest that we take a little cut to music because you do have some, and then we'll come back to the kind of the next step,
the patchwork
and
what music?
Yeah. So what should we play next?
Great. Let's go for respect and just see what happens.
Sure.
Because it ties into a lot of things. Self-respect. I mean,
sure.
Respect in your career.
You know.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Kathy Morris. So, Kathy, I have a question. What about where you were coming from, or what about what you desired, launched you into this patchwork life?
Oh, my desires.
It was your desires more than your where you came from.
Well, no, I'm sort of mulling that over in my mind, just the word desires.
Yeah. Well, you like, said you that, see it that, and you
what
want
I,
that.
What, yeah, right. I was just thinking, well, what was the I wanna? Well, I grew up in New York City, and my mother was an executive in an advertising agency. You know, I mean, if you watch Mad Men, I mean, you get her world, except that she was in the book advertising business. So anyway, there, you know, in New York City, you know, there's a lot of the best of everything and careers and all this kind of thing. And, you know, I had...
And intensity.
Yes, intensity. And so I, at first, growing up in that environment with all these incredible books around, we just had the best of it, all the Oz books, you know, I mean, just all the great, great illustrated children's books from the 40s and 50s.
Sure.
And I thought I wanted to be a children's book illustrator when I was young. I mean, so I did draw. But then it evolved into art school and sort of, the what's set out for you as a career as an artist.
Sure.
Which is, to be an exhibiting artist.
If you're on the professional track.
If you're on the professional track, yeah. with absolutely no guidance about how you actually survive that process.
No actual mentoring, just...
Yeah. Well, I mean, wonderful mentoring in terms of the creative pursuit. But
in terms of the life that you're going to live.
Yeah. When I was in the MFA program at Cornell, the assumption there, which at the time I rebelled against, or I think I just annoyed me that it was an assumption, was that you would teach. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's the only thing you can do. Is you teach. That's how you make a living.
Which is ridiculous. Teaching other artists to be artists so they can teach. I mean, it just...
It's the ultimate navel-gazing.
So, no. But then it's not, since I didn't, I went to a college art association and went to some interviews and things like mm-hmm. that. But, I just was incredibly sort of innocent in all of this. And so I ended up...
So where did your innocence take you?
Yeah, to sort of carving out a career for myself as a photographer. I had made the transition to some extent from being a painter to being a photographer in graduate school. But again, it was I had no commercial training at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, none. And who knows? It's just, again, temperamentally, maybe if somebody had tried to help me with this kind of stuff, I just would have blown them off.
Right.
So, I mean, it's all hindsight.
No, but something about you maybe didn't have to find your own path, but you pretty damn well chose your own path.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just started playing around here. Once I was, living here. Mm-hmm. I just started playing around. Well, I wasn't playing. I mean, I was trying to get jobs as a freelance photographer.
Sure.
And eventually I did set up a studio in the Ithaca Commons through the help of friends and things like that. And one friend in particular. And, I did okay. I mean, I had a working photographer's studio for, I don't know, 20 years, something like that.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And I ended up just doing portraits and weddings, and I did a lot of newspaper work, which I really loved. Yeah. And again, it was all self-taught.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I just, sort of figured out as I went along, how to do like some basic lighting and, just learned by trying things out, and it was very nerve-wracking. It really was.
Right, right. And is it, do you need that level of like fear to be as productive as you can be, or as be as aware as you can be? Or is that, was that just a, just how it happened?
The fear is a little overdone. I mean, my temperament is, yeah, you know, is it overdoes that aspect.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it's, it was, I don't really, you know, the excitement, the thrill of learning something new and all that, that's one thing. But the nerve-wracking aspect, which I really never got over. I mean, like, you know, the going to a wedding and just, you know, just kind of frantic. Do I have, you know, I have all my equipment lined up? Is everything, you know, all this, you know, is this, it just, that part of it, it was really stressful. Mm-hmm. And people, it was really funny because people would say, and the other, and also just the, to be in business for yourself, you have to learn how to deal with people.
Right.
And I got help eventually with the bookkeeping aspect, and that was great. But the, you know, learning how to deal with people, like learning how to organize, you know, 30 people into a group portrait or something, you know, mm-hmm. when it's not, you know, it's not my nature at all. Right, right. You know, I'm not, you know, I had to teach myself to be a
you
directorial
didn't sign up to be a
person.
Director, yes.
Yeah, 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 the direction, that aspect. And eventually I got good at it, and I am good at it. But, and people, you know, sometimes people would say, you know, oh, you're so calm and everything. And I just think, oh, if you only knew.
Right, you know? Right, right. So that's that was the tape in your head. It didn't necessarily project to others,
right?
Yeah,
yeah. Well, I learned how to you know, put up, fake it till I made it. You know, yeah. I mean,
right. And at some point, you were no longer so tense about everything inside.
At some point, to yeah. some extent. I yeah. mean, you know, I'm quite a bit of a perfectionist, mm-hmm. and you know, so. You know, if nothing is ever good enough, you
right.
know that one.
You've always got something to chew on.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So in cobbling together this life, what are the major pieces and how do they hold together?
Well, the art... You know, I've always sort of thought, like in yoga, there are two, what the teacher in my lineage, BKS Iyengar, you know, he talks about the two wings of yoga. But in, you know, in my life, the two wings are art and yoga.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so those are the two really essential things.
So you were self-taught in art.
No, I had tons of schooling.
But okay. But in terms of the business piece, you got
oh yeah, self-taught. Yeah, the business yeah. piece.
So, and in yoga, you also had tons of training as well as
yes.
a lot of self-teaching.
Yeah, a crazy amount of training. I mean, now in the last the Iyengar yoga path, I've had 20 years of nonstop training,
mm-hmm.
and there's to be a teacher in Iyengar yoga, you go through this really challenging certification process, and it's not just once.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like the belts in karate, you know, you so there in Iyengar yoga there are many levels, and each level you go through this years-long certification process for each level. So that's been really great, and that's been really consuming for the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's also been, like, so we were talking about stability before.
Right.
Being tied into this lineage and this whole, like, you know, this deep course of study is very stabilizing, has been very mm-hmm. stabilizing.
What did it center or shape that was unshapen or uncentered prior to your taking it on?
Well, it's a discipline, for one thing. And you know, I've always...
So you were a perfectionist without discipline.
That might be true. I hope it's not, but it probably is.
No, but that can be enormously frustrating.
Yeah.
Because right. until you learn right. some notion of discipline, you don't have any sense of accomplishment.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And it puts you at six and sevens with yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, like I said, all this is a really long, slow process. Like, I mean, at this point, I've been through three certifications, mm-hmm. right? I have many students. I have to teach all these classes, all these places and everything. But I still, you know, the self-doubt, I mean, is eased quite a bit. It's eased quite a bit. It can still pop up. It's right, just amazing.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And.
Because if I don't do it perfectly, you know.
Right, right, right. And when you say this to me, you are smiling with your mouth and with your eyes as though it's kind of a quirky friend that you have with you that comes out and announces itself now and again.
Well, that would be in my best moments, the quirky friend idea. You know, it's some of it is that, you know, there's a lot of cosmic joke aspects right, to this stuff.
That's part of what I'm getting at or trying to. But it still gets you.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. And can come out of nowhere.
And what happens to you when the doubt takes?
Oh, gosh. It can... Sometimes I can freeze. I sort of dissociate, but I have enough practice, I guess, at this point to just go on functioning and probably do a perfectly good job. But you know that just how most I think how most people feel anxiety. You know, mm-hmm. you just get tense and your mouth gets dry and. You know, things like that.
And you push on through.
And you push on through, yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Right. And yoga is, it's in a certain sense, its own response to anxiety.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And so...
it's, you know, think of the basic fight or flight response, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yoga is the ultimate response to that.
Right, and it's not freeze. I mean, there's fight, flight, freeze, are the three, and then they've when you
no, there's more
panic,
I think, but
flatter and fornicate and other things. People, but those are the five yeah. basic responses to threats of health, or connection.
Right. Yeah. Yoga is quite remarkable, and I think one of my missions is to educate people about what yoga is because. The amount of misunderstandings in this country about yoga, yoga is not about stretching. Excuse me.
Just an exercise regimen.
It's not just an exercise regimen, and it's not just chanting Om, or it's not just tuning out, or it's not just whatever or tuning in, or yoga. Yoga covers every aspect of what it means to be human. And, yoga, covers your moral and ethical life, right? And, of course, and all aspects of your physical body and your mental, emotional body and, your spiritual body. And
right.
Yeah. So it's yoga is just all these layers, integration of all these layers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And a connection that I made because I grew up being mentored by men who were born in the 1880s and 1890s and very early 1900s, and they did not have mechanized, they didn't have machinery to do their farming, and they did much of it by hand, and they had to know how their bodies worked and how to keep their bodies working with the patients and to know what it meant to be graceful and to be centered. And they would laugh at that younger generation than them who came of age trying to work these machines and stuff, and they'd lost any sense of how their bodies operated and what it meant to be centered.
That's a really beautiful way to put it. Yeah.
And mm-hmm. and they could still work into their 70s, 80s and 90s because they had respected the instrument along the way, and they took breaks quicker and they didn't push so hard to get through. I wish that I've learned so many things from them. I had their presence because they would behold you. They wouldn't, like people who are on a mission, they stare you with like two pinpoints at you. Mm-hmm. And when they look at you, but people who want to know you, they look at you with eyes wide open and behold you and see your past and present and your future and the depth and height and everything around you. And that is what I sense when you talk about yoga.
Yeah. And that's very much my goal or intention or whatever you want to call it, like that at a certain point in recent years, you know, when you get into your 60s or at some point, you realize, oh, right, this is not a finite, I mean, not an infinite, this is not an infinite process here.
Right.
So, and I thought, well, and it's always talked about in this country, you know, it's like that it's all downhill, right? And that really bugs me. So,
well, it's the worship of youth that came, you know, really to life in the 1920s and 30s and 40s, and then came back ferociously in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah. So I just, you know, sort of like it was the assumption that, you know, if you're going to be an artist, you have to teach for a living, even though I did do that. I don't like those kinds of assumptions. They really, and so, you know, I just had came up with this idea that, oh, well, what about, what if the last 10, 20 years, whatever it's going to turn out to be, what if they're like the best? You know, like what if I can really come into my own, you know, even more? Like, what if I can shed some of this, you know, some of this baggage, you know, that's haunted me? And what if I can become more and more like physically adept in my own 75-year-old way?
You know? Right. And what you say and makes sense, because what I understand that they're finding as they study people who age and from 70 to say 85, in that time where your health is still pretty strong, mm-hmm. people make peace with the paradoxes or the hypocrisies in their lives, and they find a way to hold them more graciously, and they're happier.
Yeah.
And so I would expect that would be what you would find.
And yet it's not presented that way as far in this culture.
It's just being researched, and we have a kind of a culture that we don't trust what we see. We only trust what we hear or read on some level. In a town where I grew up, when I was born in 1958, the median age then was about 60 or 65 years of age. That's the median. So there was a whole bunch of really old people who were going to die before long. And I carried groceries to them when I was 11, 12, 13, 14 years old, and went into their homes and helped unpack stuff so that they could put it away. And I saw people with interest and curiosity. There was some depression. But wherever there were connections, there was an engagement and a joy that was really very powerful. You know, and that's what the research is beginning to kind of find.
Yeah, joy and engagement. You know, definitely on, you know, what on I list. Have yeah. right, yeah. right, you know, written down. This right. is the deal here.
And what? So let's cut to music and then come back to in a certain sense the next chapter.
Sure.
Or the next chapters. What should we play next? This is Miriam Makeba and Pata Pata.
Bye.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Kathy Morris. So Kathy, as you prepare for this next chapter of your life, what did you learn from these prior chapters that have helped you to shape how you want to approach these final chapters?
Well, there's something about the balance between self-reliance and community. Like, there was a big lesson for me, which I learn over and over again every day, of course, but it was most apparent and profound. I had to have back surgery in 2005. And, you know, that's a very vulnerable kind of helpless mm-hmm. time. And so just the way people helped. I mean, you know, even when I think about it now, I feel emotional. I mean, because...
What was the way people helped?
Well, like my yoga students got together and they did a benefit to help with it. This was the pre-Obamacare era,
sure.
Right? So I had no health insurance. I'd been hoping to just kind of sneak by to 65. And
right.
I didn't make it.
Make it by about 10 years.
Yeah. So, the way that community came together, and then, you know, like the woman who was bookkeeping for me at the time, the way she helped me with the, you know, to get your medical bills reduced, you sort of like applying for financial aid. I mean, it's like, you know, it's just a huge process.
Sure,
you go through, and just that help, and, you know, the way my brother and his wife helped, and friends, and, you know, just the whole, that whole, you know, where, you know, it was the whole experience. And then the surgeon, he helped a lot.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He was pretty great. And, you know, I'm not even, you know, I'm not like somebody who spends a lot of time involved and engaged with Western medicine. But, you know, man, when you need a good surgeon, you know, it's Western medicine's really, you know, the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was a very transformative experience.
So you learned, you said it's the balance between what you do for yourself.
Yeah, and self-reliance.
And
yeah.
Community.
Yeah.
And so how did the balance shift for you then?
Well, it's always going back and forth. You know, I'm always playing with that. And now I'm just aware, you know, that I have to learn more over, you know, just it's kind of the process of learning, you know, how to ask for things, and to, you know, how to be clear about that, you know, that's almost a talent or a skill,
right? And to ask in a way that it's a genuine question, and you can
yes.
take whatever answer comes.
Yes.
And that's what's hard.
Yeah.
Is to ask the question clearly.
Yeah.
To let it be a question.
Yes.
As opposed to a hidden command or,
yeah.
or demand, and then to receive whatever response.
Yeah, and it's so interesting. Like, you know, coming up against trying to be more realistic about, you know, what I actually can do and what I need help with, and that does change as you get older. It turns out, and there's some things like that I'm not good at, like filling out forms or things like that. You know,
yeah,
that,
yeah.
So, you know, like so. Whether it's friends or professional organizations or professional people, or, you know, like somebody backed into my car last week, and, you know,
it's their fault, there's still a lot of stuff to deal with.
Oh, my God. Yeah. So just discovering, like, you know, oh, man, I really need help with this. And, you know, just even just pestering the insurance agency, you know, to help me, you know. So that kind of thing. And then looking around, like, well, what are the community resources, you know, what here in this community, like, what are the resources involved around aging?
And for me, the question is, how do you perceive yourself in engaging, being part of a community as you call on that community?
Well, it's always been a kind of a push-pull thing with me. Like, there's always been this kind of, like, seeking, longing for my tribe. You know, where is my tribe?
Right, yeah. I know the feeling.
At the same time as, for one thing, being what's called a highly sensitive person, or it's not exactly introverted, but just that I need a lot of, I have a limited tolerance for stimulation, and so I have to monitor that really carefully.
Yeah,
you get
overdone real quick.
Yes, yeah. And so then I have to have a certain amount of retreat time.
Sure,
right. So there's that, balancing that with engagement with my community, enjoying my various communities. I mean, this is a really amazing place to live because there's so many different communities.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that people who are more sensitive or more introverted, they often can, in short periods of time, offer depth to others that they might not otherwise have in relationship.
Yeah.
You can show up.
Emphasis on the short period.
Right. Yeah. I mean, but community does take time. And we live in a culture that doesn't value ambling, even for a short period of
time. Yeah. And ambling is like key to my mental health. I mean, I have to amble every day. You know, I have to have some period of ambling pretty much every day. Right. I mean, I have like a certain number of days a week where it has to happen.
Right. And then that kind of just very naturally leads into the question that I like to close the show with is, how do you take care of yourself emotionally, physically, and intellectually throughout the day, on a daily basis, weekly, monthly, yearly? And how do you know you need to?
Oh, I know I need to when I stop enjoying life.
How does that flag come up in your consciousness?
Just the basic things. Like, I stop noticing it's a beautiful summer day.
So you notice that you stop noticing.
Yeah, I notice that I stop noticing. And that I'm just caught up in my head.
Right.
And that life is short and that has to stop. So... I have daily practices. Most days I wake up and just sit up in bed and meditate for 20 minutes. That's pretty key. Again, I say most days, but some days that gets thrown by the wayside. But anyway, and then I have some sort of...
It's a practice. Yeah. It's not a... A brutal regimen.
Yeah. So then because I teach so many yoga classes, my yoga practice is often involved in preparing. It's a spur. It's a wonderful motivation to be practicing things every day and constantly learning and growing. But I have to do it I pretty much have to do it every day. If I skip a day, then it takes me 2 days to catch up in the way my body functions. Mm-hmm. So, and then, I love to read. Reading is really key to my life. And it's all different kinds of reading, from nonfiction, like right now I'm involved in Stephen Jenkinson's books, and to... just escapist fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not discount that. And poetry, graphic novels. I've been really studying graphic novels the last 2 years. Mm. So all that kind of thing. And then work in the studio, which I'm just, the last couple of years, just starting to get back into after all these years of yoga study and certification training and stuff. So I'm just starting to rebuild my art life in some ways. And then trying to focus more intensively or more deliberately, I should say, on my community, on connecting with people, mm-hmm. Having some degree of social intimacy. Yeah. So, I should say, just give credit, I have a really great therapist.
Well, there's that. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. I think therapy is it's like almost like a taboo, like talking about it. But man, I think therapy is wonderful.
Yeah, and it's hard. Yeah, we have more therapists per square inch here than most. And I mean, than most places. So a lot of people avail themselves. What does therapy provide that your other connections don't or can't?
really good listener, a really much clearer, fresher perspective that's not about, you know, I mean, all of us, when we relate, you know, it's really hard for us not to want to manipulate the other person to some extent to satisfy our needs.
Right.
Right. So, you know, that's less of that in a therapeutic relationship, if not, you know, almost none. So so that perspective is where I originally got involved in yoga, mm-hmm. and things like Al-Anon. I mean, you know, that there's a guidance, you know, a guidance and a structure,
right.
a point of view that makes a big difference. But, you know, but it's funny. When I walk out of...
And it's a stable place to come back to.
Yes, the stability is wonderful. The reliability right. is wonderful. The thing that really interests me is that when I walk out of a session, the world looks really different. Like colors, I mean, I just see things the way I see when I'm deep into my photography or, you know.
Or when you come out of meditation, I imagine, everything smells, looks
yes.
more sharp. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's really that relationship between seeing the world that way, being so much more present mm-hmm. and in the moment, you know, after a 45-minute session, you know,
right.
I mean, that's what I want people to know more about therapy.
Right.
That it's like, it's a very joyful, engaged process.
Right, right. And it's helpful to have health care so you can avail yourself of it.
That's blessings on Medicare.
Yeah, yeah. How over the course of your life did you learn that self-care is a primary role that you have?
You know, it's funny, probably by seeing my parents not take care of themselves. I mean, I think from the time I was a little kid, it was really clear to me that my mother's like, you know, martini lunches and smoking unfiltered Chesterfield regular 3 packs a day. It was really clear to me, this is not a good idea.
Right.
You know, and, you know, and seeing my father with his back issues and, you know, discomfort and his sort of the way he struggled with his temper and sort of repressing, you know, just his inability to, you know, and his frustrations about not being pursuing his creative mm-hmm. loves of his life.
Sure.
You know, things like, when I sing things like that, you know, and also the fact they had no spiritual life, you know, I mean, all those things were sort of a great object lesson in, oh, going the opposite direction.
Right.
I mean, there are many ways in which, you know, I mean, I'm not saying that I discount my parents or, you know, anything like that. It's just that there were certain, the lessons were really about doing something different.
Right. And when did you become aware, when did the light dawn or the bulb go off that you could see that they're not doing this well?
No, I think I felt it from
the beginning.
From the beginning.
Yeah.
I really did.
Yeah.
Yeah, as a kid.
And that's interesting. When I was asking about to push you out on your life, that sounds like a push.
Yeah, I think it probably was. It wasn't conscious.
No, for a long time.
Up until, you know, maybe I was in my 20s or something. But I definitely didn't want to be like frustrated about art like my father. I mean, you know,
right.
But I also got. I got a lot of encouragement too. Like right. It was a very different life than his.
And when you became aware in your 20s or whenever, when did you begin to systematically put together self-care? What did you notice first?
Well, it might have been, I don't know, you know, I have never done a timeline, but it would be a fun thing to do a timeline. When I found the 12-step programs, Al-Anon was, you know, that answered a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm.
So Al-Anon was really great. And
what kinds of questions did it answer for you?
Well, you know, the preamble is that, you know, or maybe it's the closing. You know, those who understand, as perhaps few others can, that there everybody wants. You know, I was talking about finding your tribe.
Sure.
Well, being a child of an alcoholic, it turns out you're in a tribe.
Yeah. There are predictable sorts of things that make us as we are.
Yeah. So, and the fact, and the you know, the literature, the structure is brilliant. You know, so no, I grew up totally non-religious, but that didn't mean I didn't have, you know, deep spiritual longings. And right. So Al-Anon, actually, you know, that's the key to the whole 12-step program.
Right. And it's also, I mean, we're ambling back into almost where we started. The purchase of the house provided you a structure and started a process of discipline with income and stuff, or at least that's how I kind of hear the story. Mm-hmm. But what I'm, and the word religion means religare, to religament. The ligaments, as you know, are what hold the body together and allow us to move in predictable sorts of ways. So I've never met a person who's not religious. Though many who won't claim that they're not, but everybody has a sense of how things hang together. Mm. And when you find your tribe, you find those people who share a way of putting it together and exploring it.
Yeah.
And it seems like that's what I was feeling when you were saying that.
Yeah. And then at some point after, you know, that in the late 1980s, then, you know, again, this feeling of like needing guidance. And that's, you know, where I found yoga. And I spent 12 years going to the Kripalu Center for Yoga and Health in Massachusetts. And, you know, that was very transformative. And then, you know, and then I became disillusioned with that. And then a year later, I met my Iyengar teacher, mm-hmm. whom I've been with ever since. You know, and then that filled in that piece. You know, they were talking about the discipline and you know the it was not eclectic and you know it was really following certain mm-hmm. teachings.
Right, right. And again, it gives you a sense of poise. I mean, literally mm-hmm. and bearing.
Yes.
When you have something very precise
yes.
to hold on.
Yeah, precise is a key word in Iyengar yoga. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. It's also being able to label clearly what you're feeling or what you're seeing or what you're experiencing. That kind of precision helps us to know who we are accurately and also to know how others know us.
Yeah, although I'll always love a little bit of mystery.
Oh, no. Yeah, well, I mean, knowing the mystery... isn't doesn't mean you know the details. I mean, you know the mystery. It's like it's what you sit and wonder at.
That's so funny because I feel like my art is really about detailing the mystery.
Right, right. And the irony of that is you can detail till you're blue in the face, and the mystery will not let it go.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Kathy, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Well, this was. Went in all kinds of, for me, unexpected directions.
Good. I didn't know where it was going to go either. what would you like to close with?
Oh, right. We have to... well, we never did talk much about like my whole like immersion in feminism and uh-huh. And then in women's... Well, I had a women's drum group in Ithaca for a number of years, Sound and Spirit. Mm-hmm. So, and one of our teachers was a woman, Obaka Hill. So... maybe we could close with Obaka.
Sure. And do you want to say something about that music group before we...
Oh, Sound and Spirit? Oh, yeah. That was a great time. We you know, just like in any... Well, in music, you know, sometimes women don't get the front seat that they deserve. Right. And so I was... taking classes and doing African dance and drumming. And, you know, I just got some women together and we just started meeting and drumming together and then it expanded into this performance art group. And, we did a number of performances. Eventually, you know, people went their separate ways, but that was a great time.
Right. And community in its truest sense is ephemeral. it arrives when you need it, and it goes on when it needs to go someplace else.
Yeah, we've all gone and
because it's not
floated.
An institution or an organization or even a tribe in mm-hmm. reality, mm. because it is so ephemeral that it meets us right where we need, if we're open to it, and then it goes, because we can't hold on to it; otherwise, it becomes an institution.
Yeah, that was the other music choice, Love is a Rose, right?
That's right.
Better not pick it. Only grows when it's on the vine.
Yes. Kathy, it's wonderful to get to know you.
Thank you.
Here we go.
Mother's, 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 mother's come.